Okay, if everybody will indulge, our guest speaker even recommend that he speak after lunch, but I feel it's better he speak now. We'll have lunch, and then you'll have the rest of the afternoon to enjoy yourself. I think that works better, and I'll take that on my shoulders. So it's a pleasure to introduce Cliff Liebrach, who's the director of the fertility clinic. The Create Fertility Clinic in Toronto. I want to thank him and his assistant, Debbie Davies, who really helped me in the initial planning of the program. He's a professor at the University of Toronto. He does a lot of work in the area of infertility and unfertility. And he also, I'm sure a number of you saw, they were written up on the front page in the National Post a couple months ago. He's involved in training, I don't know what it's called. He's training women who are halakhically trained how to deal with all these issues, all the issues that arise, and I'm sure that's what you'll be addressing here this morning. And he's here on vacation with his family up in the area, and it's a pleasure that he took time out from his vacation to join us this morning to offer his words of wisdom and insight. Thank you very much. And I do apologize to you for the lateness of the hour.
That's okay. So this is a difficult task to talk about this when everybody's hungry for lunch, so I apologize. I'll try my best to get through this rapidly and try to give you some very interesting insights on this topic. I think this topic, surrogate motherhood, has some fascinating aspects from both a psychosocial ethical point of view, from a civil law point of view, and from a halakhic point of view. And we have many, many patients in our clinic who have to deal with this type of issue in terms of halakhic requirements, in terms of using a surrogate mother. So I want to talk about this, and I think you'll find it very interesting. So, of course, we all know that the mitzvot of being fruitful and multiply is an important part of Judaism. And for most couples, this is one of the most easy mitzvot to fulfill. But for those who have infertility, it can become unimaginably complex, as our speakers have already alluded to. And though the history of surrogacy goes way, way back, it's not just the last 20 years when it's been done through assisted reproduction, or even in the last 80 years when it was simple artificial insemination of another woman. In the Torah, Abraham and Jacob used surrogate mothers to have children in place of their wives. And Sarah, as you know, who was infertile, gave her servant Hagar to Abraham so she could have his child. And this was apparently common practice at the time. But we also learned that there were problems, that Hagar did not want to give this child to Sarah when it was born. And therefore, this type of surrogacy, there's a risk that a bond may form between the pregnant mother and a child she's carrying even before it's born. So what are the definitions of surrogacy? There are two types of surrogates that we talk about. First is the true surrogate, which really doesn't require assisted reproduction from a fertility type of practice. And that's where the ovum is from the carrier herself. This is someone who's carrying a baby for someone else using her own egg. And basically, you don't require assisted reproduction because there's really just the use of, in terms of modern times, self-insemination, the so-called turkey baster or syringe technique. And these are the only cases in civil law where there have been legal custody issues because this really is the person's genetic baby that she's carrying. So therefore, there have been cases where she's claimed the baby for herself or tried to claim the baby for herself. And these are difficult ones from a civil law point of view, so most lawyers will not get involved in them because of the risk involved. But the one that we're going to really talk about today and what we help couples in our practice is the gestational carrier or gestational surrogate. And this is where the ovum's from the intended parent, or it could be from a donor ovum if she is unable to produce eggs, and the sperm can be from the intended parent or from a donor. And here, the carrier has absolutely no genetic link to the baby, and we require the assisted reproduction. There have been no legal custody cases in civil law in this type of situation where she's carrying baby for someone else. This woman who's carrying the baby can have her own child with her own partner, and basically doesn't pose that sort of risk. However, legal contracts are mandatory and are done where each of the people have independent legal advice, and I'll be speaking a little bit about that. Who are the surrogates who come to, in our program? Basically, they can either be a person who's already known to the couple, a family or a friend, or someone they connect up through an agency, an ad, the internet nowadays, or even by word of mouth. In our program, about 15% of the carers are related or known surrogates, and that could be a sister, that's the most common that we see, a sister-in-law, a mother, that would sort of present the ethical dilemma of a mother actually caring their grandchild. What about a daughter caring for her mother, so she's actually caring her sibling? Cousin, niece, or friend are other examples of people who may act as a surrogate for someone who's either a known or family or friend member or friend. 85% are unrelated carers, and this is the most common, through an agency generally who consults and helps them find someone who's willing to do this wonderful thing for somebody else. What are the indications, the medical indications? The first one that we talk about is where they have no uterus. If someone has no uterus, obviously the only way they can have a child is through surrogacy, where someone else carries the baby for them. The congenital absence, or the Rokitansky-Meyer-Hauser-Kushner syndrome, I think this is for Jewish guys who couldn't decide who to put the name on this condition. But basically, that's where someone's born without a uterus. However, they have ovaries, they have eggs, and they have a husband who has sperm. So they can have a baby this way. You can also have malformed uteri. You can have androgen sensitivity syndrome. This is a woman who's born genetically as a male who doesn't have a uterus. The only way that they can have children is through a surrogate and an egg donor with the husband's sperm. And a hysterectomy, obviously, if someone had cancer or some other reason that they lost their uterus prematurely before they were able to have children. They can also have uteri that are damaged through scar tissue, or tuberculosis is another cause. As well, we see also women who've had multiple losses unexplained. We have no treatment for them other than surrogacy, or multiple IVF treatments where they have beautiful embryos. We keep putting them inside, and they reject those embryos multiple times, and we've used surrogacy for that. Also, someone who's had a terrible complication in a pregnancy, almost lost their life, to have another pregnancy would be a very risky thing for them. A medical disease they suffer from, such as heart disease, diabetes, and so on. Or a mother who's on medications which could be toxic to her fetus, such as drugs like methotrexate and so on, where they are life-saving or life-enhancing medications, but for her to carry the baby would be extremely dangerous for the fetus. So we do in vitro fertilization when we do surrogacy, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with IVF. I know it's been discussed here a few times today. But basically, when we take out eggs, what we're doing here is, this is an ultrasound showing a needle going into the ovary of a woman, and the needle is piercing through the follicle or the egg sac, and it's extracting the egg from the egg sac by aspiration. And we create multiple eggs, as has been discussed here, in order to do this, and we extract those eggs and in order to then fertilize them with the sperm outside the body. And of course, in surrogacy, this is what we need to do prior to implanting the embryos. And the only difference really from a medical point of view is instead of putting the embryos inside the intended parent, the woman whose eggs they came from in general, we put them in somebody else. So that's how we extract the eggs. And then these are what human oocytes look like here. And we then get sperm from the husband. This shows sperm that's traveling actually through human cervical mucus. When we do this test to see whether sperm is able to penetrate through mucus for general fertility treatment. And this just shows that what sperm can do. And then once they get through the cervical mucus, they go up in through the reproductive canal and fertilize an egg. So in terms of fertilization, when we do that in vitro, we can do that just by mixing the eggs and the sperm together, and this is sort of a picture of what that looks like, and only one in general sperm will fertilize the egg. We also do other techniques of fertilization, which I think we've heard about today. I think we talked about ICSI. This is where we take a single sperm, and you can see it in that little pipette, and it goes right into the egg, and we inject that sperm. There it goes. Zoom, right in there, and there's the sperm going right into the egg, and we can fertilize eggs that way, especially in men who have poor sperm problems. We do this also for PGD because we don't want external sperm around the embryo that could contaminate the genetic testing. So ICSI is a very common technique nowadays in IVF. We then produce embryos, and these are the types of embryos that we transfer, the 8-cell embryo or the blastocyst. This is the 5-day appearance, and we've just seen pictures of blastocysts before, where the inner cell mass produced the baby and the extra embryonic cells produced the placenta, and this is 2 days before that at the 8-cell stage. So we transfer embryos at either of those stages. And I'll just move on here. So in terms of surrogacy, we get very, very good success rates. In our clinic, we've had over 50%, and this is pretty amazing because we have women of all ages whose eggs were used to produce these fetuses, and we get also frozen embryos that we can try again if it's not successful. So it can be a very, very successful procedure for many couples where we do IVF. So what does the law say about surrogacy? Well, this very interesting progression in Israel, I was fascinated by this, that in 1987, the health ministry in Israel actually outlawed surrogacy, and they said that the practice was just unacceptable. So from 1987 till 1996, there was no surrogacy in Israel. And basically in 1996, under the aegis of the two chief rabbis at the time, they passed the formal surrogacy law, and they ruled that only unmarried women could serve as surrogates in Israel. And so they did hundreds of cases after that of surrogacies in Israel from 1996, but they could only use unmarried women. And then in 2006, just recently, Rabbi Moshe Amar permitted a woman who had 5 miscarriages, she was impoverished, to use the service of a married surrogate in order to bring a child in the world. And this was a pioneering ruling at the time. So now in Israel, although there's still controversy, there are the use of married women as well as unmarried women who can be surrogates. Canada passed the Assisted Human Reproduction Act. And basically about 6 years ago, actually, there is allowance for surrogacy, although you can't pay a surrogate, you can reimburse them for their expenses. And the expenses involve things like clothing and time to go to the doctor's office and so on and so forth. So the lawyers are able to make contracts that allow for all of the reimbursement. Interestingly, you can do surrogacy, you can get reimbursed, but you can't pay someone to get you a surrogate, to find you a surrogate. So it's a interesting quirk in the law, so that's not allowed in Canada. Also, a surrogate mother must be at least 21 years of age, which is reasonable. In our program, also, we only allow, in general, surrogates who have had children before. And the reason for that is that we feel that to give consent, first of all, I think is much more difficult for someone who's never had children. And we are very worried that someone's carrying a baby for someone else, and if they should have a complication that could affect either their life or their ability to have children in the future, that's not something we want to see from an ethical point of view. There are interesting civil law issues that basically involve that we always have to have a contract with independent legal advice for both parties, and there's financial issues involved in the contract of expense reimbursement, etc. How many embryos to transfer are part of that contract, the custodial arrangement that it's going to be the baby of the intended parent, abnormal baby. What if the baby's abnormal? The parents must accept the baby in any condition. So that's part of a contract in most cases. as well as state issues. What happens if both parents died in a car accident or a plane crash, or were incapacitated and weren't able to look after the child? What would happen to that child? We can't allow someone who's caring a baby for someone else to then be responsible for that child that they didn't intend to be. So it becomes very interesting issues that come up in the civil law area. What about in Judaism? Well, we know that, you've all heard today that the interests of fertility medicine and Judaism coincide perfectly. We want to have Jewish children, and we want to help people who can't have Jewish children to have Jewish children. But it's difficult, you know, with this field, as you've heard today, is changing so quickly. How do we ensure that they're not violating halacha? And I like this quote. I'm not sure who said it, but I think that, you know, where there's a rabbinic will, there's a halachic way. In other words, if we can find a way to do it through still following halacha, then we want to make it happen because we want to have these Jewish children. This is about an article that we just heard about from Rabbi Jay that we are helping couples that want to have supervision during IVF, and I know this goes on a lot in Israel as well, and other American fertility clinics, and it was titled How to Make a Kosher Baby. I thought it was a perfect title. And basically, I was involved in training a group of women in the art of how IVF works, and also in the issue of supervision, and to make sure it's their egg and their sperm, and follow all of the halakhic issues that are involved in IVF. Other religions, in terms of surrogacy, Catholic position, as we've heard, that it's highly immoral, that they don't allow it whatsoever. In Islamic law, using a surrogate is only permissible if the husband marries the surrogate, at least temporarily. So I thought that was very interesting. What about in Judaism? Well, there have been many ethical arguments against surrogacy over the years, and hence the initial Israeli law. Rabbi Jacobitz said it's demeaning, that it's against human dignity. That was his argument. Rabbi Gordas said it was commodification. It verges on slavery, that a woman's paid to carry a baby for somebody else. There's the argument that it limits this process to the rich because it's very expensive to do surrogacy and to reimburse all the expenses and the legal contracts, so that the rich are more entitled to reproduce than the poor. What about some people feel, although it's not technically adultery, but if third party is involved, making it close to that, will it affect the couple's relationship? And of course, the Torah commandment, honor thy father and thy mother. Who is the mother to be honored? What about the counter arguments? What are the pro-surrogacy arguments? Well, most rabbis feel that it's not a commodification. If the surrogate is reimbursed a reasonable sum, as in the Canadian law that's there, and I'm sure in Israel as well, and as long as they are being reimbursed for what happens during the pregnancy, that may be okay. And of course, the typical surrogate is not in fact poor, but a married woman with children, who's middle income, who has many years of education, whose husband is supportive, and this woman has had positive experiences with her previous pregnancy. While it's expensive to do this, yes, but that's not unlike many things in our society, that some people can only afford to do certain things. But there are governments that do cover medical expenses, as in Israel. And in Canada, myself and many of my colleagues are working towards coverage for fertility treatments in Canada. We think that will come someday. Also, civil law prevents the slavery argument, that there are these contracts that we've just talked about. So it helps to prevent the woman have the surrogate to have rights over her own body during the surrogacy, and also that she would not be stuck with looking after a child she didn't intend to. What about the halakhic issues? The critical question, as we've heard already, is maternity. Judaism, of course, descends through the mother. So the big debate here is whether the host or the genetic mother should be the child's mother. And the consensus, I think, for most rabbis is that it's the host mother who's considered the mother, as she's the one giving birth, regardless of the source of the eggs. And a Rabbinic Assembly Committee on Jewish Law and Standards came out that the religious status follows that of the birth mother. And since making sure the child is considered Jewish is paramount, many rabbis, and I'm sure the ones in this audience can talk much more eloquently than I can about this, it now endorsed that there be conversion at birth when it's not a non-Jewish woman carrying the baby. However, when it's a Jewish woman carrying the baby, that may not necessarily be necessary. One of the interesting dilemmas that this poses, if a Gentile surrogate were then to convert during her pregnancy, she becomes Jewish, does then the baby become Jewish? That's an important, interesting question. It also, theoretically, that if a child was born, if you consider the surrogate to be the mother, and the child's born from the surrogate, and this woman, the intended parent, the woman whose eggs this baby came from, had children before, could that woman, could that child, who's not really from that woman, marry they could potentially marry their genetic sibling? That would be a problem that could be difficult in terms of adhering to halacha. And also the question of whether a surrogate can be a married woman is something that was wrestled with in Israel and has now potentially been resolved. So I'm going to conclude with this quote, which I think Rabbi Brander also quoted as Rabbi Mamieri, a medieval rabbi who said that any advances achieved through natural science are not to be considered magic, which is prohibited. There will come a time when science will know how to create human beings without the natural intimate act. This has been explained in the books of science and is not an impossibility. It's permitted to be involved in such procedures, for they are considered within the order of nature and not in the category of magic. So I thought it was fascinating that this medieval rabbi said that. So I think we're really at the beginning of all this in terms of the technology. I couldn't imagine the things I'm doing now from when I started 20 years ago in this field. And I think also we're at the beginning of understanding how halacha and reproduction intermix. And these are very fascinating issues, I think, that are going to be wrestled with in the years to come. Thank you very much.